Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum, on Facebook and on Twitter @InforumSF. I'm Courtney Cochran, founder of Your Personal Sommelier and the author of Hip Tastes, The Fresh Guide to Wine. And I'm really excited to be here this evening and to be questioning these very kind folks about inexpensive wines, certainly a topical topic. Tonight we're here to discover the secret to finding delicious wine on a budget with Inforum's program $10 or Less Wine. Young enophiles, winemakers, and educators are finding new ways to create and enjoy tasty varietals without draining your wallets. So let's move our palates beyond Two-Buck Chuck and some of San Francisco's leading vintners as they introduce us to exciting new trends and blends. Tonight we're hosting, to my left, Doug Du, who, as the director of wine and beer for Grocery Outlet, is constantly on the hunt for the best deals from the best wines. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
To Doug's left, we have Chad Richard, the co-founder of Furthermore Wines, which recently was awarded 5 gold and 3 bronze medals in the tasting and labeling competitions at June's San Francisco International Wine Competition. Welcome, Chad. And all the way over to my far left is Dorian Kendall, the creator of Budget Vino Blog, the online source dedicated to featuring great bargain bottles of wine. Thanks for joining us. So let's get started. You know, the economy has certainly had a lot of impacts across the board, and one of the things that is actually kind of fun to talk about in this context is how we're finding creative ways to spend less on wine. We all want to continue to drink well during the downturn, and so let's get to it. To that point, Two-Buck Chuck came out a while ago, and folks kind of said, is this the end of the industry? You can now get wine for $2. Good Lord, what does this mean? And, you know, how has the downturn affected the industry? Do you guys think that that was a sort of a downturn for us? Or
I actually don't think so. I think the Two-Buck Chuck got a lot of people to try wine for an inexpensive rate. The first year or two that Fred was making that wine, it was decent California juice that he was buying for 7 to 10 cents a gallon. Unfortunately, it was so successful that he became a market maker, and instead of jumping to 12, 14, 17 cents, he went straight to 16 cents and kind of unraveled his business model. But as far as I'm concerned, the Two-Buck Chuck really got a lot of people to drink wine again. It was inexpensive enough that you didn't have to commit to it. If you didn't like it, it was okay, which unfortunately in the latter part of that lifestyle, it wasn't that good. But Fred is an innovator, and he's doing a lot of things to shake up the industry. And whenever you get more people to drink more wine, hopefully you take that occasional drinker and you move them over to a regular drinker.
So it sounds like not the end of the industry.
Yeah, I would agree that it's in some ways it's the beginning of the mass market for wine in America. Wine has oftentimes been perceived as somewhat of an elitist thing, and the industry, unfortunately, has reinforced that for several decades. And wines like Two-Buck Chuck, I think, are starting to now make it a lot more accessible, where if you're not sure what you like, you can try a wine that's not going to break the wallet, and it is about finding the wines that you like. So is Two-Buck Chuck a good wine, or was it ever a good wine? For some people, it certainly was, and for others, it never was. It depends on what they like.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, I think in our minds, we're all experts, right? I mean, you drink an expensive wine, You know, people come to you and they say, this is what you're supposed to think potentially, but you are an expert in what you drink. And if Two Buck Chuck is a great wine to you, then absolutely. And I think what's interesting, you know, in my own personal experience, I was never a wine drinker. To me, it was always sort of way out there. I didn't want to spend $30 for a bottle of wine. I'd rather bring beer to a party. When Two Buck Chuck came out, that really opened up my eyes to this whole new drink that I had never tried. And from there, you know, I've obviously sort of extended on to other wines, typically under $10, but sometimes a bit more expensive. But it really just allows you to become an expert in your own right. So.
Terrific. Yeah. Thanks. So I have a burning question. Is it okay to take a $6 wine to a party? Should you perhaps be considering a six-pack of beer instead?
I'll just jump in on that because I just did that. you know, it's actually really interesting. Depending on the party, I mean, it really, you have to sort of gauge your audience. But I know when I'm going to parties, if there's a lot of people there, there are some great $6, $7 bottles of wine. And let's be honest here. If you go to Safeway, there are so many options. Granted, not everyone's going to recognize every label. You can be really sort of unique in your choices and still bring a great bottle and not break your bank.
I think that's a great point. So you can bring bottles that aren't, you know, people don't see on the supermarket shelves and they know the price because they're on sale every week.
Exactly. There's old tricks.
Yeah, I think there's definitely nothing wrong with bringing a $6 bottle to a party. I mean, one of the great things about wine is it's really sharing with other people, and what a great opportunity when you're at a larger party. You can bring something creative, bring something interesting, bring something that you think people haven't tried, and if you can introduce them to a $6 bottle they like, then you'll be the hero of the party.
I agree 100%. If you buy a $6 bottle and everybody else bought a $30 bottle, then you still have four bottles left over at the end of the night. That's always a good thing. The harder you work to find the great wines, the better off you are. The only caveat to that was if you're going to a trophy dinner, you're going to the father-in-law's house, you might want to bring a trophy instead of a $6 wine because they might be keeping an eye on it. But there's great $6 wines.
That's great. So consider the occasion. All right. Certain varieties. Are there certain grape varieties? So we talk a lot about Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Chardonnay, some of the most popular varieties that come to mind. Are there certain varieties that work better under $10? And are there certain varieties you should avoid that don't turn out well under $10?
I definitely think there's some varietals in conjunction with regions that are going to be harder to find real high-quality wines under $10. Furthermore, we're Pinot Noir producers, and I wouldn't recommend many California Pinots that are under $10. I think Castle Rock is one that I would recommend as kind of a safe bet, but there's not a lot of great $10 Pinots. But if you're interested in exploring something like Australian Shirazes or Argentinian Malbecs or Chilean Merlots, you can really find some great values there for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on my side, I've never really been able to pin down one varietal under $10 that I think excels beyond all the others. Typically, you'll see sort of later on, my favorite budget wine is a wine called Red. It's a blend. I mean, sometimes those are the most fantastic wines. Sometimes you find an excellent pure vintage, like, you know, the Bogold Zin, for example. Those are great wines, but I guess to me, I've always sort of looked for that. I've always sort of questioned, is there one wine that's always amazing under a certain price or one that I should always be looking for? And I'm yet to sort of find that. I think it's across the board. And again, the best thing about under $10 wines is you can try, right? You can just try as many as you can and find what you like.
The barriers to entry are pretty low.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd just like to add that there's a lot of wineries that have the blending varietals, Cabernet Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec, things like that, that don't work out in their blends, the red table wines. And so they're forced to bottle them up. I worked for Golden State Vintners years ago, and they had a Petit Verdot that was unbelievable, and it only came out every 3 or 4 years because they blended the rest of it out. But when you have the opportunity, take a look at those off varietals. Cabernet Merlot and Chardonnay are always the mainstays, but if you find a nice Cabernet Franc, you can get it. It's a great deal, and it's not that it's a bad wine. It's it didn't fit in to their blending programs.
Thanks, Doug. Are there any other varieties? So you mentioned Cabernet Franc. I heard Shiraz. I heard Malbec. Any other varieties that come to mind? One thing I know that we talked about just before we got together was sometimes red wines tend to be more expensive at this lower end, and you can find more value more often in whites and rosé or blush wines. Any particular varieties there?
Yes, some of my favorites there are in the whites for value. I would say Sauvignon Blancs, specifically from South Africa or New Zealand. I think you find a lot of value. Rieslings, Rieslings are really diverse wine. It's a great food wine. Sometimes they're dry, sometimes they're sweet. If you think you know Rieslings, go back and have a few more, and you'll find a lot of diversity. And a lot of times I really encourage people to explore wine with food, and you get a very different sensation than having wine as a cocktail. So a lot of your food wines, I think you can actually get some nice value on.
That's terrific. Okay. Lots of wines under $10 have critter labels, these labels that have animals on them. Does that mean they're not serious wines?
It's kind
not
of a tough one.
Not to put you on the spot or anything.
It's a tough one. I mean, you know, everyone these days, I think the trend is to have fun with your label. There's, again, when you go into your Safeway or your grocery store, there's so many different budget wines. Now the market has gotten so huge that everyone's trying to separate themselves from the guy next to them. And so they're trying to be creative with their labels. Sometimes I guess animals sort of capture your attention, but yeah, I haven't seen.
Anyone else want to care to comment on that?
Actually, I just think it was the printing company that had one stencil and they just used it over and over again, put in different pictures. Everybody has their own affiliation. My wife and I had our own winery in the Napa Valley for 5 years, and our dog was more famous than us because she made it into two books. She wasn't on our label, but she was still more famous. Whatever the winery can do to connect with the consumer is what they're trying to do. And so whether it's the use of critter wines or beautiful landscapes or the story that you should always read on the back of the wine bottle, they're just trying to connect with you.
Yeah, my take is it doesn't make them good or bad. I'm slightly offended by all the critters running around on the labels. The average wine buyer is female, and they found in market tests that women relate to animals, and they find that they don't know some of the labels potentially, but they go like, oh, there's a cute fox. I'm going to get that wine with the cute fox. It sold wine, so they kept doing it.
Well, what about, as a follow-on to that, I think a lot of the perception with wine, especially for new wine drinkers who comprise a lot of the market during even off-recession times for under $10 wines, are perhaps a little bit intimidated by wine, and maybe this is one way to make wine seem more approachable. I don't know, do you guys?
Yeah, I could see that.
Sure. Can't disagree.
Absolutely. Okay. All right, let's move on. So, let's see. We've talked about some regions and some grape varieties that tend to come across well under $10. What are some factors or trends that predispose a region to produce wines of value or just inexpensive wines, and is there a difference?
Well, on the production side, I'll start there. But on the production side, a lot of it starts in the vineyard, obviously. And if you're in an area where it's very low yield in the vineyard and you're getting maybe a ton per acre, that's going to be some expensive wine because you're not getting a lot of grapes off the land, and the land is expensive and maintaining the land. Some of the other inputs that you see in the cost of wine is what's your access to workforce to actually work those vines. And in some regions, it's really expensive. And in California, we're starting to regulate, you know, who's working the vines a lot more. And it's going to increase the price of wine potentially. And so those are just some of the inputs, you know, from a geographic and viticulture level.
Sure, I agree. When Oregon and Washington started growing fruit for wine, it was an infant industry, and they didn't have much following or brand building yet. And now you see a lot of Oregon wines that are on the same price level as California in a shorter period of time. Same with Washington. Some of the appellations in Washington are just as expensive. And when you go into a new area and it's undeveloped, everything is less expensive, the land, the opportunity to build, the barriers to entry. And so you can produce wine for a smaller amount, but then opportunity cost shows up. And when you can sell an acre of land for $100,000 and you could make more money selling your fruit or using it for something else, you have to increase your bottle price. If you were a person that bought land in the Napa Valley in the past 5 years, unfortunately you're upside down in your vineyard right now, but you also wouldn't be able to sell anything for under $55 or $60 just because of the cost structure that you have into that bottle. So when you look to the new developing regions, you can really fall in love with the wine. You're going to see it double over the next 5 to 10 years as they grow in popularity. The other part about that is when you first develop land, you really don't know what you're doing for the first 3 to 5 years. You don't get a harvest that you want, that you can make fruit of for the first 3 years. You're stumbling around for the first 5 to 7 years till you really dial in to what you can do and what you should be producing and the styles of wine that come from that region. So when you're not as good as you're going to get, you can also get those wines a little less expensive.
That's great. So we've talked about some things that make it that make wine expensive, high cost of production and so forth. What are the key inputs to the magical combination that yields wines that are both inexpensive and good, would you say? So the other side of the question, I guess.
Right. So some of the inputs there could be not having to use French oak barrels, for instance. So when you make wine, French oak barrels, about $1,000 usually, and you're getting 25 cases of wine out of that $1,000 barrel, you can use it 1 or maybe 2 years. It's one of the reasons why you might find some more value in the white wines, where you don't necessarily you're using stainless steel and other forms of fermentation, and also able to do large batch processes. And then back to sort of the viticulture, if you're in a region where you can get 4, 5, 6 tons per acre, maybe more, you're able to harvest more fruit. And some varietals are going to be better suited for that than others. A varietal like Pinot Noir, it's very small clustered, and you want the vines to struggle, so you're not going to get a great Pinot if you're doing 6 tons per acre 9 out of 10 times. You want to see it more like 2 tons per acre, and that's going to inherently be more expensive. But other varietals, you can certainly have great wines that are made in something like a 6 ton per acre yield.
Great. So ordering wine in a shop. I'll just pause for the noises of San Francisco that are always here. Should I be embarrassed if I go into a store and say my budget is $10 or $15 or $20?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it depends on the store that you go into. But, you know, some specialty stores, I don't know if they'd love you for asking that. But, you know, again, the wine world has really embraced, not the wine world necessarily, but wine shops especially have embraced the sort of under $10 market. It's good turnover for them. And, you know, oftentimes they like showing you a good value. They like to point it out to you. I mean, K&L, for example, which is a store here in San Francisco, their email list always spotlights their under $10 or close to $10 sort of top choice. So obviously it's a market that's really pushing a lot of volume, and it's really of interest to these wine sellers. So I don't think they'd be offended at all.
I agree. Depending on where you go, I had a wine shop in San Jose that I sold to, and he didn't have anything on his shelves for under $35 because of what he paid his staff and the overhead. He said if he had anything under $35, he wasn't making money. He was actually losing money. So depending on where you go, you're not going to go to Las Vegas and buy a $6 bottle of wine. But there are a lot of people in the local regions or even within the valleys that have wine countries, Napa and Sonoma, up in the foothills, Lodi, that you can find a small wine shop that has wonderful deals. And never be afraid to ask for whatever you're looking for. The only caveat with that, I would say, is if you educate your palate, you can't go back down. So work your way up slowly.
Yeah, I'll just add to that in today's recession, I speak to a lot of people who own wine stores, and right now, most of the people are buying mostly bottles around $10. So you may be embarrassed to go in and ask that question, but that's what's moving, that's what they're selling, so no need to be embarrassed at all.
Okay, so this question, Dorian may be primed for this question. Are there any online and or iPhone or mobile applications to help discover new wines under $10 that you'd recommend?
Yeah, I mean, obviously my own site would be a great place to start. but, you know, I've always loved going to blogs. I think, for the most part, a lot of bloggers are very honest. There's a lot of great blogs out there. You just search for wine under $10, you'll find a lot of great options. And then if there's stores that you really like, I mean, K&L is one of my favorites, so I keep bringing it up, but I always go and search their sites. You know, to me, again, blogs are just, they're a great, great forum for people to discuss. You get a lot of feedback. The one thing I love about them is that, you know, if I say I like a wine, people are not hesitant to tell me if they liked it or hated it. So you really can get, you know, you get multiple perspectives on the same bottle versus other conversations which are one-sided, like going to a store.
Yeah, I would say do your research, because we do live in a very information-rich age. One of the primary resources I use before I ever buy a bottle of wine that I'm not familiar with is called Cellar Tracker. And Cellar Tracker is something that lets you track the wine that you're buying and drinking and lets you do tasting notes as you drink your wine. They just had their 1 millionth tasting note this week, so there's a lot of tasting notes up there. And it could be just, you know, Joe next door, so why are you going to trust his palate or her palate? But what you do is if you read 5 to 10 reviews on a wine, you're going to be able to tell from the aggregate. You'll know if people are enjoying this. Is this a better food wine? How are they rating it? You'll see consistency in the comments, and you'll get an idea if that's the kind of wine that you're going to like. And I find it incredibly useful.
I would recommend winesearcher.com, also winesnoot. There's a new website out. Actually, you go and you sign up for it, and they send you email every day. And it's winestillitsgone.com. And there's a lot of opportunity to find information online. Sometimes it's better for you to go ahead and purchase a case and spend the $15 to $25 for the shipping, because you know you're going to enjoy it instead of going to your local shop and trying to find it in that local shop. So I think a lot of the online marketing and sales websites do a wonderful job of bringing you a lot of variety in one application, and you don't always have to buy a case of one thing. I'm sure that you could buy half a dozen different bottles, and a lot of them offer free shipping, so you don't have to leave. There's plenty of different ways to find great deals and the wines that you're going to like online.
And are there any particular iPhone applications? I know that there are so many that are coming out all the time right now focused on wine that you would personally recommend?
I have a BlackBerry Storm, so no.
Let's see. I actually have several. So let me point out some of my favorites. There's one called Corks, C-O-R.kz, and it actually lets you tie into that Cellar Tracker site that I was just mentioning, so that database is in there. One thing that I keep handy on my iPhone is Robert Parker's vintage chart, just so you can have an idea of what some of the vintage ratings are, and can't live and die by it, but it's hard to remember it all, so it's a good one. And then the Wine Enthusiast app will be the other one that I'll recommend that I really like.
That's terrific. And just a couple from me, too. I know Snooth, Snooth, S-N-O-O-T-H, has a ton of wines online. They also have a location-based search. You can find wines on the go that you search for. That's one of my favorites, so... All right, so restaurants, how to save money in restaurants on wine? There are a lot of different strategies. Some of the things that you can obviously do are bring your own, and certain restaurants have on certain nights, they'll have free corkage or reduced corkage, or bring one and then have waive corkage on the second. But what about when you're ordering from the list? Are there any particular types of restaurants that are going to have more value wines in terms of the cuisine, perhaps, or take it away?
Well, one trick I learned this week, and I didn't necessarily mean to do this, but I went into a restaurant, brought a bottle, and I was expecting to pay the $25 corkage fee, but I did offer the server a taste of the wine. He waived the corkage fee. So
that's
you might try that.
Too. That's happened to me, too. Absolutely. Any other strategies? What about particular types of cuisine? So perhaps not French haute cuisine, right? That might not be the place where you're likely to score the $30 bottle on the list. But where might you find something like that?
Well, a wonderful Greek or Italian restaurant is going to offer you a lot of table wine, so that they'll go with a multitude of what you put on the table, where if you're going to Ruth Chris or Morton's, you know that that they're going to take you.
I have heard that the margins that some steakhouses charge are oftentimes some of the highest in the industry, so perhaps that's... You go elsewhere if you're looking to save.
Yeah, I definitely would not go to a steakhouse. A good friend of mine works for a steakhouse, and we walked through the whole margin on it, and it was incredible. I mean, they were selling a glass of Ray Station, which is a wine you can get for about $12, $13. They were selling per glass at $17. Yeah, so you have to be really cautious. One really thing I always sort of recommend is, as you sort of go into this world and you educate yourself more with what's out there, stay conscious of the prices. And when you go to these restaurants, you know, maybe it's not always the right place to order the inexpensive wine that you know is $7 at the store, but they're charging $35 for it. Maybe that's a time that you try the more expensive wine, and you don't go for that bottle. Because I know myself, I'm very frustrated. The more and more that I know the prices, that I walk in, I say, my God, how can they be charging this much for a Ravenswood Zin, for example? But I would say also, I wouldn't go to a French bistro expecting like a fantastic wine for inexpensive, but there are some good lower-end choices cost-wise available in a lot of sort of American eateries, especially in the San Francisco area. So.
Absolutely. And also, if you arm yourself with some of these new iPhone or mobile BlackBerry apps, you can check the prices while you're there. You can be the ultimate price sneuth. So let's see. So Shiraz and Malbec, these are some of the grape varieties we hear about over and over again where value is concerned, and Shiraz being predominantly grown in Australia and Malbec from Argentina. And did we get lucky with these wines sort of coming onto the market sort of in sync with the economic downturn, or has that been happening for some time?
I'll start with that one. It's been definitely happening with some time, and I think we did get lucky that it coincided. I think there's a few things that were happening. In Argentina specifically, they've been producing wine there forever. It's been a big part of their culture, probably longer than it has here in California. But what they've recently done in the last 15 to 20 years has really shifted their focus towards much higher quality wines. Not unlike what we saw here probably 1 to 2 decades before that in California. So as they started to shift towards higher quality production, they still had this association that they made cheap wine, so they couldn't really charge California prices. But in many cases, the quality was just as high. The other sort of stigma around it is Malbec. And although Malbec is, you know, one of the noble varietals that makes up a Bordeaux blend, very few people knew what a Malbec was, and it's not a great standalone varietal in many regions. You don't find a lot of California Malbecs, for instance, and you don't see it in French wines as a single varietal. It's part of a blend. But it turns out in Argentina, they make an amazing Malbec based on the terroir there and the climate, and it really produces high-quality wine. But they had to really earn that and let people fall in love with it over a period of time. And you can still find a lot of great Malbecs in the $10 range, but you can also spend some money on Malbec as well.
Anyone else have any?
Yeah, it's interesting because I was sort of thinking again over the last couple of days, sort of my favorite regions for inexpensive wines. And I think we have this conception that especially Australia, when we look at a Yellowtail, it's kind of the shining example of the inexpensive wine in the region it's attributed to. But I actually love a lot of California under $10 wines. And it's surprising because when you talk to a lot of people, they think that that's just not possible. The California wines are really expensive. They're typically of a higher price point. I found some fantastic, you know, wines from California. And I think primarily it's because the market has gotten so big that people want to play in it. They want to make money. They know that especially in this economic time that they can turn over a lot more bottles. And so there's so many more players in that area, and there's really some great wines out there from California. So I think it definitely we don't want to ignore that region even as we look, you know, towards Australia and Argentina, et cetera.
And one region that is so key for value that it has not come up yet, and I'd love for you guys to give some thoughts on it, is Spain. So this is a tremendous region in both reds and whites, and sparkling and rosé, actually. So there's so many great things there. Do you have any particular brands that you've enjoyed from Spain or thoughts you'd like to share?
Actually, I'd rather go for the varietals, the Prosecos and the Cavas I really enjoy from Spain. I'm not a European palate. I'm a California fresh fruit up front type of a guy, so I'm not really a big fan of a lot of the European styles of wine, terroir first and the fruit comes afterwards. So I would say their sparkling wines are my favorites. There are some very nice dry rosés coming out of Spain, but we're on the West Coast. If you're on the East Coast, you can find an abundance of them, but out here they are a lot more difficult to find.
I would say the Tempranillo and the Tempranillo blends coming out of Spain are amazing, and a lot of great food wines. So, and you can find great value there. And I'll also echo, you know, if you want to spend $10 on a sparkling, you're probably not buying French champagne. But a cava, you can find a great cava in that price range.
And so cava just being the champagne-style sparkling wine made in eastern Spain. So oftentimes comes in at $6 a bottle. It's a great, great party wine. And from mimosas, I find.
Yeah, one other thing is, just jumping on your comment, Doug, about Spanish wines under $10 on the West Coast, a really great alternative to Spanish wines, if you like the Tempranillos, is Chile. There's some fantastic Chilean Tempranillos. Like, there's this one called Olla de Cadenas. It's fantastic, and it's under $10.
Great. Okay, so buying in bulk, is that a good strategy to save money on wine? What other strategies might you look towards, perhaps big box retailers or what?
Well, buying in bulk is always what the retailers want you to do. Come in and stock up and then come back and drink more. A lot of people offer 10% off on a six-bottle purchase, so that's nice. Last fall, Safeway was offering 20% off $20 bottles or higher, and if you bought six or more, they gave you 10% off more. That's 30% off. When you see a deal like that, you should stock up if that's your price point. If you time it right, you can time it where the regular retailers will be moving on to another vintage, and so it doesn't end up on the regular shelf space, but it ends up on an end cap in the store, and it's at a discount. Again, give it a try, and you can stock up that way. But also, I would just say, check the internet, make a couple of phone calls, or do your own research, because there's always a great deal on wine. You just have to get out there and fight the battle to find the bottle you want.
Dorian, did you have?
Yeah, no, sure you have. I love the six bottle 10% discount. Is just it's my Graceland. I love that. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. But one of the things, one of the tricks that I personally like is just to, you know, extend out your wine. So if you're buying an entire bottle and you're not going to drink it all in one night, what I did is I went out and bought a vacuum. It's about $10. That in itself will help save your wine for an extra couple days. Throw it in the fridge if it's a red. You can probably get an extra 4 to 5 days out of that bottle. So I think that's another way to actually save money, is just these little tricks. Instead of just buying as much, just maybe if you're not going to drink it all, just store it away for a few days.
So you mentioned a vacuum. Are you talking about like a Hoover?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They have these special, they're called Vacuvins. I mean, there's all these different brands out there. You can go online to Amazon, for example, and find them. Again, they're about $10. They're just little, they almost look like spouts you put on top of the bottle, and it just sucks all the air out. And it's really great for preserving wine.
Terrific. Well, I actually have an internet question from the land out there. The web. What's the best Riesling wine I can buy for less than $10? Is it American or German?
We have a half a dozen German Rieslings. Two of them are estate, and we're selling them for $5.99, and I think they're wonderful.
Okay. I would agree. I would say German for sure.
I'm not a big white wine drinker, so I'm the last person to ask about white wine.
Okay. So alternative packaging. Boxed wines are becoming much more popular now, not only for their cost savings, but also for their reduction in their carbon footprint. What other kinds of alternative packaging would you recommend looking to for value in wine? And do you have any examples?
Well, actually, I met with Joe Franzi yesterday, and he showed us that Crane Family $3 Koala. And an average case of wine weighs about 38 pounds. His glass is actually 32 pounds. So because of the weight restrictions when you're shipping wine on trucks, he can fit more of his cases there, which ultimately ends up landing it at the store and on the shelf for a cheaper price. So traditionally, you looked at corks and you looked at a large punt or double glass, and you thought that that was a form of quality or an inflection of the quality and level of detail that the winery was going to. But at the end of the day, I think a lot of that can be excessive. And if you're really interested in what's inside the bottle instead of what's on it, then you can go with the smaller packages. They started off with the big bottles and the box wines, and they were pretty bad when they first came out. There are some decent producers. Target has a wonderful wine box that's made by the Trincaro family, and it's $16. It's the equivalent of four bottles of wine, so I think you're getting it for $4 a bottle. It's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I believe it's called the Wine Cube.
I'm sorry,
if you're looking
the Wine
for it.
Cube.
It's fine.
Thank
just
you.
To help folks find it.
But there are definitely some good deals out there. If you're looking for, if you're a true dry drinker, and a lot of people talk dry but drink sweet, if you're a true dry drinker, you're going to have a difficult finding a good box wine. But if you can take a little bit of residual sugar, a little sweetness, there's some decent wines out there, and they last 30 days in the refrigerator.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add on that. That was quite informative. I would say stay open-minded about it, because we are going to see more experimentation moving forward. There's a lot of great reasons to do so. So stay open-minded. Great wine can be put in all sorts of different containers.
Yeah, I would also just say, do not fear the screw top.
And why? Can you give us a bit of a background, Dorian, on why screw caps are cool?
I wouldn't go as far as say they're cool, but you know, just going back on what Doug was saying about this whole obsession with cork and plastic, etc. You know, the wine itself, when you do a screw top, it's obviously not going to get chunks of cork in it over time. Cork doesn't dry out. It's sealed so that no air gets in. There's just really no reason why it shouldn't be looked upon as an effective way to actually bottle and store wine. Unfortunately, though, I think there's so much obsession with cork, and unfortunately, it gets lost in that way.
Yeah, it's tough to break with tradition.
Yeah, absolutely.
But a lot of wines under $10 do come with screw cap closures, and they're very effective. And you don't have to worry about cork taint, which does affect, I've heard anywhere from 4 to 7% of wine bottles closed with cork closures. So it's a risk for spoilage, and this eliminates it. I think that's pretty cool.
There's a lot of high-end wines now, too, which come with screw tops. I've purchased many $30 and $50 bottles of wine that come with screw top. And when you're walking somewhere for a picnic and you want to bring less things with you, that's the bottle you grab.
And, Chad, I know you mentioned that you like half bottles. Can you talk a little bit more about how value can play in there?
Absolutely. If you're looking to spend less on your wine tonight, maybe you can increase sort of the price per full bottle by buying a half bottle and maybe drinking a little bit less. If you're having some wine with a meal and maybe you're just by yourself, you wouldn't finish the whole bottle necessarily anyway, so why not buy a split? And we're starting to see a lot more of these splits or half bottles for sale, especially at places like grocery stores where they know you'd be serving it with a meal. Restaurants oftentimes have it. So I think it's just another good way to keep an open mind and kind of think creatively around how you're not going to spend a lot of money on your wine, but you're going to drink some great wine.
Right. And sometimes saving money on wine is just eliminating waste, reducing the amount that spoils or that you pour down the drain because you didn't drink it in time. So I know that Dorian mentioned the vacuvin. I believe vacuvin, if you want to use the French accent or not, which you can use to conserve the wine. And then also some of the boxed wines, just a quick comment, they have a collapsible bag inside that shrinks with the wine, so the wine isn't oxygenated over time, so you can keep the wine for up to 2 months sometimes. So that's a great way to make sure you're not throwing wine away.
I have another trick along those lines. I'll buy a half bottle of wine that does have a screw top. I'll drink that bottle one night. I'll wash that bottle, keep it with the screw top. Next couple days, you're opening a bottle of wine. You know you're not going to finish the whole thing. Right when you open the bottle, pour it in the half bottle, put the screw top on, put it in your refrigerator, and there's not going to be any oxygen in there, so you're going to be fine. The wine's not going to oxygenate. You can drink that half bottle that you have remaining tonight, and then you have this self-made half bottle waiting for you in the fridge when you want it.
So even red wine, too, you'd recommend storing in the refrigerator?
I would. I would put the red wine in the refrigerator. There's two things that are going to basically cause the wine to oxidize, and it's oxygen, and certainly temperature is going to help facilitate that and act as a catalyst. So if there's the least amount of oxygen as possible, and then you drop the temperature of it, it's not going to oxidize. And then you probably want to bring it out of the refrigerator about 10 minutes, 15 minutes before you're going to drink it, let it warm up to room temperature, and then enjoy.
Terrific. So I think I'd be off base to wrap up today without talking about Australia, which for a long time has been known as sort of the homeland for value where wine is concerned. And is it still a great place for value, and where do you see Australia going?
Yes, it is, and we do. We had an importer show up with 80,000 cases of $17 to $20 Australian wines with purchase orders from Safeway, and unfortunately the distributors wouldn't cooperate with them, so it ended up here in California. We've sold about 45,000 cases of that, and our retail price is $2.99 a bottle for Australian Barossa Shiraz that should be 17 to 20. I think Australia offers a great deal of opportunity. Over the next several years, they keep talking that their harvest is going to be back in balance. But when you see the offers that we receive, it still isn't. And I think we have 2 or 3 years there. I also think South America is another great opportunity because they're out of balance with their production and their sell-through. So whenever you see a country or a region that's producing more wine than they sell or they consume, then there's always an opportunity to find a great deal.
Any further comments? Is Yellowtail here to stay?
Yeah, I don't think Yellowtail is going anywhere. Just one thing, just jumping back to the value discussion and how you can actually get some great value. One of the things that I love to do is around January, February timeframe, go up to wine country or contact some of the vineyards. A lot of them are releasing their new vintage, and they're selling a lot of their older ones at a discount. You can get some great deals on cases. It's pretty staggering what a discount you can get. So I would definitely reach out to some of your favorites and just see if they're going to be giving any sort of case discounts at any point.
Just a quick announcement for the audience. In about 5 minutes, we're going to begin taking questions. So if you'd like to start thinking of your questions and perhaps even lining up at the mic over here, in this part of the room over here, that would be terrific. Okay, so top 3 party wines under $10. Doug.
I actually brought 2 of them. So I have a Chardonnay and I have a really nice Pinot Noir. Our business model is a little different than the traditional business model. We look for opportunities where other people have failed to complete their job. There was an importer that went out of business earlier this year, and he was sitting on 32,000 cases that we were able to sell. We, on average, were selling it for 29 cents on the regular retail dollar. So I have a $9.99 Pinot Noir that would usually be about $30, and I have a $10 Chardonnay that would be about $35. So, again, depending on the business model and the opportunities that you see in the market, we have 134 stores, and we can pick up a lot of wines in a short period of time. And so we try to take advantage of the system to offer great values at a great price.
And so your wines are from where?
These 2 wines are actually from South America. The Pinot Noir is the Punta Alta. And then the Bouchard Finlayson Chardonnay. Actually, the Chardonnay is from South Africa.
Number 3?
Number 3 would be the Cava that we're carrying right now. I guess this is a commercial. we have a wonderful Cava from Spain. It's $5.99. It's soft enough that you can drink it by itself. It would pair well with any foods. And for the next morning with those mimosas, it's wonderful also.
My favorite. Chad.
So my 3 would be Castle Rock, Pinot, Sonoma Coast. I think that's a really great value. I would say Penfolds makes this great Shiraz Cabernet blend from Cooranga Hills or something along those lines.
In Australia.
In Australia, absolutely. And then there's an Argentinian Malbec I really like called Palo Toso, and that's just a great $10 Malbec.
Dorian, I know you have some in your back pocket.
Yeah. I actually brought all 3 of mine, so we can taste them after. My absolute, absolute favorite now of all time is made by St. Francis Winery. It's called Red. It's a blend. So many times I've brought out wine that's been expensive and then brought it up as a follow-up, and everyone loves it. So it's a great foolproof wine to bring to a party especially. Cellar number 8, which is one of the Behringer lines, always good. And then Bogle, they make a ton of different wines. One which I particularly love is their Old Vine Zin. It's really just rich and delicious.
Terrific. Okay, final question. So a lot of times we're thinking about, especially in this economic setting, we're thinking about not only budget wine but also budget cuisine. And you know, how do we touch on both of those and make a great, reasonably priced meal? So I'm just going to mention a couple of these different types of cuisine, and if you guys could suggest a couple wines, that'd be great. So pizza.
Well, I'm a big Zin fan, and I would go with Zinfandel with pizza if you're like the hearty, spicy style. Or I would go with a dry rosé from Spain. It would also pair well with it.
Terrific.
I'd go with a Barbera or Sangiovese-based wine like a Chianti.
Yeah, to me, it's whatever's on my pizza. So if it's a spicier pizza, I'd probably go with something spicier like a Malbec. If it's something more vegetably, I might go for something a little bit lighter, like a Pinot.
Okay, terrific. What about sushi? And not, perhaps not so valued. Let's talk Thai.
I would go with a Riesling with Thai.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's actually one of the only times that I venture into the white world.
And why is that?
I just find, especially Thai food and Mexican food, Rieslings, the sweetness just matches really well with the spiciness. It's a perfect combination. Reds, I find, don't really match as well.
Or on the Mexican, staying with that sweet theme, going with the sweet Zinfandel can work really nicely.
Terrific. Sure. Burgers, final question.
Well, what was that wine that they had in Sideways? Anyway, Merlots are wonderful. I like red table wines because they're rounded and balanced. They're approachable at a younger age, and they're usually less expensive. So I would go with the red table wine with the burger.
Merlots, it's one of the few times I'll really match a Merlots with a burger.
Okay.
Unless there's bacon on it, then Pinot Noir can be really nice with that bacon cheeseburger.
Yeah, I would go with any heavy red Syrah Merlot Cab.
Terrific. All right, well, now it's we're going to be turning things over to the audience for questions, and I just want to thank you gentlemen so much for your thoughts. And so, yeah, thank you. And as a reminder, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, and tonight we are hosting $10 or less wine. I'm Courtney Cochran, founder of Your Personal Sommelier and moderator for the evening, and in discussion with Doug Dew, the director of wine and beer for Grocery Outlet, Chad Richard, co-founder of Furthermore Wines, and Dorian Kendall, creator of BudgetVino.com. Let's go to questions.
Question is for Doug. I actually have two questions. First one, I'm a regular customer of yours.
And, thank you.
But frequently, by the time I get around to tasting all the wines that I bought the last time, you're out of that. And I'm a little embarrassed about drinking wine in a parking lot. So the first
That's
question
so strange.
Is, do you have any tips for someone like me? That's number one. Number two, your store in Grants Pass, Oregon, mm-hmm. apparently does wine tasting once a week or so, but I'm not aware of that in the Bay Area. Do you do it in the Bay Area? And if so, where? Or would you consider doing it?
Sure. Well, the first part of the question, he's actually telling the truth. We have customers come in on a regular basis, buy two or three bottles, go out into their parking lot, into their cars, try the wines, and then come back in and buy their cases. Because of that, we are a discontinuous business model. We will buy as much of a wine as a supplier will offer us. But when it's gone, it's gone. You don't get a chance to reorder it. So the first thing I would do is sign up for the email list that all of our stores provide now. Talk to the operators or the department manager to see if you can line your pallet up with something that we're carrying. And we have about 30 wine stewards in our stores right now, but that'll be a big initiative next year. Unfortunately, in California, for the second part of your question, you actually need a 42 license, which means you basically need to be a restaurant to pour wine. Our Elk Grove store does have that capability. A lot of our stores have been partnering with catering companies or other restaurants in the area so that the restaurant goes out and gets a one-day license so that we can do pourings. But California is quite restrictive. All of our stores in Oregon can do wine tastings. We have two stores that are part of a pilot program up in Washington, and we expect to do wine tastings in all 31 stores up there by this time next year. So hopefully California figures out that it's not a bad thing to offer customers the opportunity to try something before they buy it, even if it is alcohol.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes.
I actually have more of a comment, and of course I'm interested in your comments afterwards, but a region that was not mentioned that is definitely worth it and has great value wines is the Balkans, especially Macedonia, Croatia, some of them being Tikvesher, Tagazayug, and Dingac. So I was just wondering as far as your opinions. They tend to be earthier, heavier wines, but they're wonderful.
Panelists?
I think we're all a little stumped on that based on everyone looking around. So I think my comment on that is there are just some amazing new wine regions around the world popping up, and things that you wouldn't have known about or things that weren't making – areas that weren't making wine 10 years ago, maybe making great wines now. So I would say keep an open mind once again, and I think I'll have to do a little more research and explore those. So thank you.
I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
Actually, I think I read somewhere where the Balkans were the best growing region 2 years ago in the entire world when it came to wine, and I didn't even know they grew wine. So as we become more of a global economy and things can shift around, I would assume that all the Russian satellites made some sort of wine. I'm just looking forward to trying some ice wine from Russia sooner or later.
And I would just add that I think part of the problem may be distribution. So until those wines are really in the market, it's difficult for the mind share to grow. So I've heard they're coming. So we'll look forward to it. Yes, sir.
Can you say a little bit more about evaluating blends? I mean, I've had the experience of, I think it was a $7 California blend that had about 15% Zinfandel, and I thought that really added a lot to it and actually liked it better than something $5 more that was a Zinfandel variety. What kind of varieties should you look for in blends? And I'm thinking especially South American, Spanish, Eastern European.
So I can start on that. Some of the, I think the traditional blends that you'll see are kind of the Rhone blends. So you'll see like the Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre blends. And you'll find those all over the world or in many places, including Australia, California, native France, of course. Another classic blend would be the Bordeaux blend, where you have the Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Malbec, Petit Verdot, Cab Franc. And you'll see, you know, subtle variations, maybe two of those, three of those blended together. Those are two of the most obvious blends. What are some other?
Actually, what I would say is when you don't recognize the varietal on the label, chances are it's a blend. I agree. I've always liked the red table wines better. They're more rounded and more balanced. I love Napa Cabs, but there are times where there can be a little bit of a hole in the middle of it, and you put some Merlot in there or some Cab Franc, and it really rounds it out. I also think that they're approachable at a younger age. So if you're buying a case of wine and six of them are Cab and six of them are red table wine, you'll be able to drink the red table wine first while you have to lay the Cabernets down. That is my palate. I love the versatility of putting a bottle of wine on a table, and it matches a lot of things, which is what your red tables and white table wines can do for you, where when you go, when I go with a Howl Mountain peppery spicy Zin, the only thing I can have with that is a pepper-encrusted T-bone steak.
The other thing about blends, which I think are real interesting, as a winemaker, you are very limited if you're making a single varietal, and especially if it's a single vineyard, single varietal release. But if you have these seven different grapes, like a Chateau Neuf du Pape, for instance, which is in southern France, they're pulling from 12 different red varietals, and they have this amazing opportunity to really blend and come up with their own recipe based on the vintage, based on their vineyards. And your opportunity to make a wine that you're going to love is increased because you can really play with those elements. Whereas if you're just growing Cabernet and you're doing a Napa Cabernet, you sort of have what you have and you do the best you can with it.
I mean, to me, it all goes back to the whole idea of everyone's an expert. For me, I like things that are heavier on Cab Franc. I love Cab Francs. Personally, when I'm looking for a blend, I try to go for a wine that really sort of emphasizes a varietal that's one of my favorites. So if Zin, for example, is one of my favorites, which it is, I'll try to go something that's heavier on there. But again, it's the one nice thing is you can just try a bunch and sort of see what sort of fits your fancy. I personally, again, I don't really have any sort of preferred mix. It really is just trying and seeing sort of what works.
And I'll add just that there are tons of blended, especially red wines, that are great value. And I think that they wind up being sort of soft and really approachable. So it's a great question. Thank you. We have a few more minutes, folks. Are there any more questions? There are no wrong questions or bad questions. Wine is a fun topic, so great.
What would you recommend with Indian food? Like a lamb curry or chicken curry?
Terrific. Okay, I'll just repeat that. What would you recommend with Indian food, for example, a lamb curry?
I would go with another Riesling or a sweeter white style wine to offset the spiciness of the food.
The thing I love to drink with Indian food is actually a sweeter Zinfandel, so it's red, obviously, but what I tend to do is serve it chilled, and I find the chilled, red, sweeter Zinfandel is just amazing with spicy Indian food.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the same thing. To me, Riesling, or actually, and I always pronounce this wrong, Gewürztraminer is another
yes,
one.
Yes, that's a great
I always
one.
Pronounce that one wrong, but they're very similar to Rieslings. Again, any spicy food, Indian, Mexican, Thai, I always I'll prefer to go with one of those.
That was a perfect pronunciation,
oh,
by the way.
You. Thank you very much.
And I'll add Pinot Gris to the mix. That's another great wine that sometimes has a little bit of residual sugar that's terrific with Indian food. Yes, sir.
Question for Dorian. Have you ever paid a $25 corkage fee on a $10 bottle? And if so, how did that make you feel?
I have not to date, but thank you.
Actually, the other question I have is for Doug. You mentioned laying bottles down and aging them. Are there any bottles in the budget category that you think are varietals that will age better than others?
Yes. Actually, I am of the opinion that most wine is released too young, and it improves over the next 6 to 12 months. Even the very most inexpensive wines sometimes are a little green, or they might even taste a little like grape juice still instead of composed wine. So even if you're spending $2 or $3 for a bottle, you can lay it down for a little while, and it should improve with age. I did want to comment on your first question. My suggestion is to always bring your red and then buy your white, and they'll waive the corkage. So if it's a $25 corkage, you can buy a $40 wine. You're only spending $15 on the wine because you would have spent the $25 anyway. And you bring your red, which is the more expensive bottle, and you'll save more money on that because of the markup of the restaurant. So always bring what you want to drink.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to know what the distribution of cost is. I know Trader Joe's sells a $4 wine. How much does it cost to make the wine, and what's the distribution cost, and what is the profit margin?
There you go.
Okay, that's an easy one. Well, I think it depends on where you are. If you go to a custom crush facility up in the Napa Valley, they're going to charge you about $35 for winemaking. You buy a $4,200 ton of fruit, and you're going to get 60 cases out of that. You're looking at, what is that, $70? 7, 6, 42? Thank you. $70 in the case. So now you already have $105 into that. You put it into a nice package, you're probably looking at $30, $35. So if you just wanted to do a basic Napa Cabernet, your set cost is probably $135 to $140. Before getting there, and that's if you don't own anything. If you buy some land and put a winery up on it in a house, you're talking millions of dollars. When you look at the other side of the industry, when you look at what the guys at Bronco can do, Franzia, I think he probably has a $16 to $18 case cost into that product, and then the distribution channels take over from there. So that's why you can find his products out there for for $2.99, because they actually get to the retailer for about $2.25.
And so the distributor takes a portion, right? I think the question was asking also about how the distribution model breaks down.
FOB, if you're a winery and you sell to a distributor, you sell it usually for 50 cents on the retail dollar. They mark it up 33%, or a $10 bottle. The winery will sell it for $5. The distributor sells it for $6.67. A retailer will sell it for $10. And a restaurant will sell it for somewhere between 12 and 18.
The stuff you maybe didn't really want to know, right? Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a question about the use of aerators or decanters for value wines. Do you think it makes much of a difference, Venturis or things like that?
It's a great question. Again, the question is about aerators or decanters. Does it benefit value wines to aerate them prior to drinking?
I'll take a first crack at that. On a lot of the reds, I would say absolutely. I think giving giving the wine a little bit of air, especially if you're drinking it young, which most of us do, and especially in the sort of less expensive price range, wine hasn't really had its full opportunity to mature. I really echo Doug's thoughts on people drink their wine way too young usually, and that's actually starting with the producer releasing it at far too young of an age. Most 99% of all wine is purchased the week consume the week it's purchased. So you buy it at the store, you're going to drink it that week most of the time. So giving it a chance to actually age, if you will, a little bit through exposure to air is great. You don't need to do it, in my opinion, with white wines. The heavier the wine, the more interested I am in doing that. So if I have a young Cabernet, for instance, I am definitely going to let it spend some time in a decanter. With older wines, you may want to be careful. There may not be as much life left in them. They're still going to go through a metamorphosis as they're exposed to air, but you may get to that situation where an hour or two, you're really not liking that bottle anymore, perhaps, because it's been exposed to air for too long.
But fortunately, it's tough to damage a young wine, right? So air right away. We have just a few more minutes. I've got to believe there are at least a couple more questions in the audience. Anything you'd like to know about value wines? Okay, I'm going to turn it back over to the panelists then for a couple of... Let's talk a little bit more about some of those cuisines. We were mentioning some of the value cuisines, and I know a lot of us don't have time always to cook a meal, and so we're doing frozen meals, or we're eating takeout frequently. What kinds of wines are going to pair well with those? We didn't talk a ton about Mexican food, so a couple wines for Mexican food.
Well, again, I am I'm one of those guys that I like to offset the spiciness of that with a sweet wine. I usually go with a Riesling or a Gewurz. I haven't tried to chill down a Zin. I will definitely give that a try.
Yeah, and for me, I prefer red wines dramatically over white wines. So you want that sugar content to combat the spiciness. So chilling that, you know, nice sweet Zin is what I like to do for things like Indian food and Mexican food.
I mean, I always find blended reds to me, while they do seem kind of harsh, I guess, to match with Mexican food, I always just sort of throw that out the window and just go for it. They always seem to work for me. So,
blended reds.
Yeah, any blended red. I'm a good blended reds typically.
Sure. Are there a couple on the market that you can recommend for us all?
Yeah, I mean, Red by St. Francis. it's the easiest one to remember.
We're all going to go buy that after this.
One comment on the food side. So I cook every once in a while. One of my favorite things to cook is chicken piccata, and it always calls for wine. And one of the things that I've really found over time is that you should never use wine in food you're cooking that you wouldn't normally drink. But there are some amazing wines that you can use for cooking, such as Geyser Peak has a great Sauvignon Blanc that works very, very well. But the other thing I would say is don't ever use a Chardonnay to cook with, because it just does not work out.
It doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Final question. Yes. Yes, sir.
I wanted to know about the health benefits of drinking wine and whether the $10 wine offers the same benefit as the more...
That's a fantastic final question, the $1 million question. Can you get the same health benefits from drinking inexpensive wine as you can from drinking everything else?
So it's a Revestrol, I think it's called, is the medicinal sort of benefit. I think they said on 60 Minutes did a report on this a couple months ago, which I'm not sure if many people saw, but I think they said you'd have to drink something like 1,000 bottles of wine in a night or in a week or something to actually get the full benefit. But any red wine...
I heard that as well.
Which is
I was very
disappointed. I mean, it's a great night, right? But... Yeah, the red wines, the tannins. I mean, it's the tannins of the Revestrol is so. It should be the same regardless. The white wines don't have that same benefit because of the lack of tannins.
That's a great point. So the red wines tend to have the majority by far of these beneficial compounds. Yes, Doug, would you have a final comment?
I would just like to comment. I think you're referring to the French paradox, and the difference is they have 3-hour meals. They take a break in the afternoon. They start off at 5 weeks worth of vacation. So it's really a completely different lifestyle. If you're grabbing a burger on the way to your next sales call or your next meeting and you don't treat yourself right, there are no health benefits to it. But if you can sit down at the end of the day and give yourself 15 minutes and a nice glass of wine to unwind, I think the stress benefits that that'll do are, will do wonders for you.
That's a great way to end. So I just want to say, let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight. Now this, and they've asked me to bang this gavel again. So this meeting of InForum and the Commonwealth Club is officially adjourned. I'll see you outside tasting.
Thank you.